Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED. Hey there, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on The Breakdown, we're in Sacramento talking to another congressional hopeful. This one's a Democrat running in the Central Valley.
That's right. Assemblymember Adam Gray is in studio with us. He's taking some time out of his busy end-of-session legislative schedule to talk about running for Congress in the 13th District. That's an area with a lot of agriculture, and Gray himself grew up in a dairy family. We'll check in with him about Governor Gavin Newsom's new water plan, or not, released a few hours ago, and talk about why he's never been scared to butt heads with fellow Democrats.
Look forward to that.
But first, speaking of Democrats, Governor Gavin Newsom got a new Chief Justice, or named a new Chief Justice this week, elevating Patricia Guerrero, who's already on the court, and appointing another Associate Justice, Kelly Evans. Scott, you always follow this judicial stuff closely. What are your thoughts on these two women and kind of what it means for the state?
Well, you know, I was struck when he appointed Patricia Guerrero because she's from the Imperial Valley, you know, not a place that you think of as, you know, home for a lot of associate justices in California. Kelly Evans also grew up in public housing in Oakland. And if you think back to the last governor, Jerry Brown named three justices, and they were all Ivy League, Yale, Harvard grads, all great justices. And that is not the course that this governor is taking. Patricia Guerrero, local product. Kelly Evans grew up in, as I said, Oakland, went to Stanford, UC Davis Law School. Different kind, and really much more humble upbringings, I think, than some in the past, as did Martin Jenkins, who is also the first openly gay, and he's black as well, member of the court. So I think all those things are important. And it's also interesting, I thought, how quickly he made this decision. Because if you think back to the first appointment he made, Marty Jenkins, it really seemed to take forever. So I don't know if they had a heads up, maybe, you know, that this was coming.
Or any of the other appointments he's made, Padilla.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like
what's
like
happening? Yeah,
waiting.
Exactly. But I think, you know, this is, you know, this is not like the 1980s, you know, when we went from Jerry Brown to Duke Majan and all those judges got removed. I mean, this is an increasingly Democrat appointed court. I think there's just one left, Carol Corrigan, who was appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger. So it'll be interesting. I think, you know, I was a little surprised that Guerrero got elevated just because she is so new. She's only been on the court for a few months. And, you know, not only are you the chief judge on that court, you're also in charge of the entire court system. So it's a lot of administrative stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, that was Tani Kantil-Sekaue, you know, who's leaving, had a lot of headbutting with lower court judges and the judicial council. So it'll be interesting to see how Patricia handles that kind of more admin side of things.
Yeah.
I mean, Kelly Evans, a familiar face if you've been around Sacramento for a while. She was in the AG's office for a while, worked for the ACLU, really pushed some of the bail reform conversation.
Former public defender.
Yeah, and then worked in Newsom's office, apparently helped him shape that moratorium on capital punishment. So I think definitely more of a left turn with her. But I mean, in my experience interviewing her, she's also very much, you know, a lawyer, very sort of not bombastic, very down, you know, down the middle on a lot of stuff. So
did we say she's openly gay as well?
Right.
So she's the two now openly gay justices on the court. And, you know, both of these are historic in their own
right.
way.
Yeah. First Latina to
be chief justice.
The court.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, before we take a break, there are a lot of bills coming up that we're going to meet their fate in either the legislature or on the governor's desk. One of them is SB 57. This is a safe injection site. That's what proponents call this. Scott, you were out at a news conference this week with supporters urging Newsom to sign it. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Scott Wiener from San Francisco is the author of SB 57. And, you know, this is a bill or similar version that Jerry Brown vetoed when he was governor, thought that it would be promoting illegal drug use. And, you know, Wiener and the people who appeared with him, including Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf, say, hey, look, what we're doing now is not working. We've seen on the streets of San Francisco and Oakland and L.A. so many people just, you know, either using fentanyl and dying or using some other drug that had fentanyl in it, and they're dying. And so the idea is create these pilot projects in these three places, L.A., San Francisco, and Oakland, and see if it makes a difference. You know, Libby Schaff said, what we're doing now is just filling up the morgues. And while there are people who have, you know, legitimate concerns about sanctioned sites where people are shooting up, at least they'll be doing it with supervision and possibly steering them into some treatment.
But we're also hearing some nervousness among supporters of the governor, with perhaps an eye on a 2024 run in other states that might not be as progressive as California, is, you know, might not be open to this. And we should say he did say in 2018 when he first ran for governor that he was very, very open to this idea. Just today sort of demurred, said, oh, I haven't looked at the text of the bill yet. So, I mean, I don't know. It'll be interesting because Newsom, you know, helped legalize marijuana in California. Like, he has always been very anti-prohibition.
He has, and he's been on the leading edge of other things like gay marriage. He took a lot of flack from that when he was mayor of San Francisco from people like Dianne Feinstein, who thought it was, quote, too much too fast. So we'll see. I mean, I think if he, you know, didn't have these presidential ambitions, which he denies, but clearly has, it would be a pretty easy call for him, you know, but I think because of the situation, because his name is getting mentioned and he is getting a lot of attention, it's going to be a close call. We'll see. He's got 11 days to decide.
All right. 11 days. You heard it here. All right. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Democratic congressional candidate Adam Gray. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
I'm Jonathan Hill, host of The Weeds. And I know that politics can feel like a joke, and not always in the ha-ha funny way. On The Weeds, we try to split the difference.
When you think run out of money, you think we're going to get to a point where, like, one guy retires and Social Security is like, sorry, y'all, got to board up.
Like that's it. Sorry, he got the last check.
I always call him Jim. Like, Jim got it. Sorry, y'all. He got the last check, and that's all the checks we got, and Social Security is no more.
Check out The Weeds every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer. Today we have with us State Assemblyman Adam Gray. He served in the legislature for the past decade, where he's often sparred with and sometimes been punished by leaders in his own Democratic Party, but they're all lining up behind his run for Congress. Adam Gray, welcome to the Breakdown.
Well, thank you. It's so great to be here today.
So we mentioned that you grew up in the Central Valley. You were born and raised, I believe, in Merced. Your parents owned a dairy supply business. So I guess my first question is, what does that mean? Did you guys have dairy cows? Were you processing milk?
What were you supplying?
What does that mean?
Yeah, so my grandfather started a company, Merced Dairy Supply, which was really two businesses. One business selling dairy equipment. So if you've been to a dairy, milking equipment and the like, we sold that equipment. We installed that equipment. We maintenance that equipment. In addition to that, we had kind of what you would think of as a traditional kind of family feed store. Bunch of different agricultural supplies, a store you would see in, we would sell chicks once a year.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. And people come in from around town and other just ranch supplies, right?
Yeah.
Rope and whips and feed and dog food and all kinds of different things.
Did you milk a few cows as a kid?
I have, yes. Although, like I said, I didn't grow up on a dairy and our family didn't run a dairy farm, but you know, certainly spent a lot of time as a kid running around dairies.
Yeah.
So what was your childhood like? I mean, it seems like it's really influenced how you've approached politics, but how would you sort of describe sort of every day growing up in Merced?
I had a great childhood. I mean, Merced's a wonderful town. It was a smaller town when I was a kid than it is today. Obviously, now it's the home of the University of California at Merced. And,
which you helped.
It's growing quite a bit. But it's a wonderful place, you know, with small town vibe. Grew up four or five blocks from our little feed store and, you know, spent some time. My grandparents farmed pistachios out in La Grande, California, and I'd run out there a little bit and run our bikes around town and, cool. You know, small town life.
Yeah.
Did you, of course, the Valley has changed politically, continues evolving. It's thought of as the most, one of the more conservative parts of California. Were your parents political at all, or you're a Democrat? Are they Democrats, or were they? And, you know, are you one of the few blue members of your family, or is it pretty purple?
No, most of my family are Democrats, including my on my mother's side, my grandfather, that was a wheat farmer in North Dakota, committed Democrat, a big fan of FDR. And I guess that tradition's been passed down, you know, through our family, but there's other families as well in rural California, rural America that I think continue with the Democrat tradition. But you have seen, you know, from the time my grandfather had the dairy supply to my generation, I think you've really seen things switch to a predominantly Republican registered group. You know, a lot of people in rural California feel like the Democratic Party hasn't done right by agriculture and hasn't done right by rural communities.
Well, I know that I think your first sort of taste of politics was volunteering on Dennis Cardozo's campaign as a maybe teenager?
As a teenager.
Was he a family friend?
Yeah, he was a family friend. Okay. And I mean, it's a small town. You kind of know everybody.
Yeah.
The Cardozo family were well acquainted with my family. I had the opportunity to be involved in some campaigns in high school, both helping Dennis get elected to the assembly at that time, but also some just community efforts around saving the library and getting recycling, curbside recycling in Merced, California. You know,
those bread and butter issues.
How do you think growing up, you mentioned agriculture, how do you think growing up where you did and having the childhood and young adulthood that you've had, how do you think that colors the way you look at issues and politics generally?
Well, I've always found, you know, there's so much attention in the media and in the national kind of spotlight around the political parties, right? And for good reason. I mean, there's these big organizations that are pushing out their agendas and ideas and advocacy. But so much of what politics really is electing people to improve your quality of life where you live, right? And I think folks in rural communities have different needs than people in big cities, right? And too often, you know, we kind of lose sight of that in the work we do. And while your political party may set the foundation for some of your values, I think a lot of your needs and your work is more informed by what kind of community you represent. And in small town, rural California, I think, you know, that's another thing about growing up in the Valley. We have a little bit of a chip on our shoulder because we feel overlooked. Because when people talk about California, does anyone say, oh, is that where the farms are? You know, you don't hear that, right? You hear people talk about the beach and San Diego and Los Angeles.
Until you get a California tomato and then you're like, you know.
Well, that is the funny thing, right? Like you run around the country and you go into a grocery store and so much of it's made in California.
Although people in Jersey think their tomatoes are better. Just FYI.
That's a whole other podcast. Well, I want to ask because you ended up, I mean, we talked about you volunteering in high school and then I think you went to a couple of years of community college, but you went to UC Santa Barbara.
I did.
That's where I went to.
Yeah,
we overlapped for a year or two. What was that experience like? Because after that, you came back to Sacramento and the Valley, but like, yeah. I don't know, how did that impact you?
Yeah, so I put myself through community college working at the family store, right? And at that time, I don't know if they still have the same programs, but they had these transfer programs from the community colleges where you could, you know, kind of set a course for yourself. And then, you know, I signed a transfer agreement with UC Santa Barbara, which was kind of a Central Southern California school. And worked my way through the community college, got into UCSB and spent 2 years there and got a bachelor's degree in political science. And I love Santa Barbara. I mean, just to be on the Central Coast, and it's a beautiful place. It's a wonderful school. Certainly enjoyed my time there. But I also enjoyed my time at community college and frankly glad I did it. More kids ought to do that. You know, you cut your cost in half and get a great education.
Totally. So we mentioned that you'd worked for Cardozo. You also worked over the years for former speakers Herb Wesson, Fabian Nunez. You worked for Jerome Horton, Ron Calderon, a long list of folks. What did you learn from them? I mean, what do you...
Like real range there,
that's
too.
A range,
politically,
yeah.
Personality-wise.
A couple of them got in trouble along the way.
Yeah, I had a great experience working in the legislature. And you learn a lot, right? As a, but, you know, all the way from being an intern to, you know, being a chief of staff and really learn the ropes of how public policy is made and, you know, what the trade-offs are and learning about the two houses. I was lucky enough to get to work both in the state assembly for a number of years and then had some opportunities in the state senate. And I think it was an invaluable experience. It was one of the inspirations, in a sense, to run for state assembly. Watching how the bodies worked, watching how my part of California didn't get its fair share or didn't get put in the spotlight very often here in Sacramento, and kind of our needs and concerns weren't always at the top of the agenda setting here in Sacramento. And I'll tell you, when I first started in the legislature back in 2000, there was still remnants of kind of those term limit legislators who had been around for decades, were very experienced, and people have different opinions, you know, about that. But the place operated in a very professional manner. And over the course of a dozen years working for different members and very diverse set of different members that I got the opportunity to work for, you saw that experience kind of wither away. Mm-hmm. You saw at one point the average staff person in the legislature, I think it was like 3 years. The average member was around 3 or 4 years.
Well, and they were going through speakers like a revolving door.
They were going speakers. I mean, I think I saw five or six speakers during the time I was a staffer. And I saw an opportunity. I said, here's a kid from a small valley town who's had a dozen years of experience in how the place operates, how, you know, to say where the bathroom is.
Hey, you have more institutional memory than 90% of the building.
And I thought, well, maybe if I run for assembly, I can do better than some of my colleagues. Not because I have, you know, LA's got 25 votes for their needs and the Bay Area's got a bunch of votes in their delegation. We don't have that in the San Joaquin Valley. But maybe if I know how the place works and they don't, maybe I can punch above my weight. And I tell you, looking back now 10 years later, I do feel like I punched above my weight.
You've been described by the LA Times as wily. You embrace you that?
Hey, if I was a boxer, that sounds all right. Huh?
Yeah, right. If you're just joining us, you are listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Marisa Lagos, here as always with Scott Schaefer, and we have congressional hopeful current assembly member Adam Gray with us. So, I mean, speaking of that, part of the reason you've had to be wily is because you are a more moderate, business-friendly Democrat mm-hmm. during a decade where the legislature has gone increasingly to the left. And I'm curious, like, how do you think about approaching that? Because, you know, you've taken tough votes on tobacco, guns, water issues, push things that folks in your party didn't love. Mm-hmm. Is that about representing your district? Is it about your personal beliefs? Are those the same thing?
I think it's probably a mixture of all of that, right?
I mean,
the first and foremost thing on your mind at all times as an elected representative is your constituents, right?
You know, hopefully.
Where do I think they're at
yeah.
on an issue? And of course, they're not monolithic in their beliefs, right? They're in a lot of different places. You have constituents that have very differing opinions on certain issues. But you want to get a sense of where's the majority of my district at, and then what is in my district's interest based on the information I have in front of me, right?
And what's possible,
exactly. What's the art of what's possible? And then you kind of finalize all that with, you know, what are my deeply held, you know, personal beliefs or values, or, and how do they apply, to each of these, set of choices, right, which we're making. And frankly, it's a great experience doing that. I mean, it is fun to work with people. I've taken on tough issues. I think there's a lot of hypocrisy in both parties. You know, I mean, you bring up tobacco.
Yeah. That's a good point. Because you were head of the committee that oversees tobacco when flavored tobacco and vaping was becoming really big.
And I'll just give you a perfect example of you know, what I see as kind of hypocrisy. Some of the same folks that are busy trying to ban tobacco or perhaps strictly regulate certain types of tobacco are the same folks that are pushing for more dispensaries and flavored marijuana gummies and all kinds of things, right? And so you kind of evaluate those policies and go, this doesn't seem super consistent, does it?
BS meter.
Right? And I think you see that in both parties, right? And in different issues. I mean, that, you know, I use that as one issue, but, and I try to be a little more authentic in my brand and representing my people. And I think that people that grow up in small farming communities, I think we have a certain practical nature in the way we think about things. And we come from a place where you make a lot of stuff, right?
You know, if you drive up and down the I-5, you see all kinds of billboards railing against Nancy Pelosi, railing against water policy.
Actually, I just drove up there last weekend. It was all Newsom. It was all Newsom signs right now.
He's stolen the spotlight.
She's on her
they
way out,
they were actually a little less mean than some of the previous signs, but they were definitely calling out Newsom saying, don't send our water to the fish,
and
right?
And you do see signs for the bullet train high-speed rail, which goes right through, you know, the Central Valley at the moment. What do you think of it? Should they pull the plug? You support it? How do you feel?
I support public infrastructure, and I think we ought to build more trains. I think we ought to build more dams. You know, one of the things I say to people is oftentimes here in California, if you find a super conservative individual, they'll be staunchly against the train, high speed rail, right? Mm-hmm. And then you'll find some of the lefty environmental coastal voters who, you know, don't want to see one dam put up anywhere, right? And I say, wow, the only thing you guys have in common is not building things.
Right.
And maybe that's the problem here in California, right? I mean, this country in some of its most prosperous and successful decades was because of our investment in public infrastructure, schools, roads, trains, dams, and all the great jobs that those projects create and generational wealth and opportunity for families. And frankly, I think we ought to get back to getting as much public infrastructure that does a public good, whether it be a new dam to store more water. I mean, as we face climate change and many of the difficult issues and these unpredictable weather patterns, isn't it obvious to all of us that we need more ways to store water when we have it,
right?
So that we can get through the times that we don't? But yet we don't move forward with that stuff, right? Because you've got people that are single issue advocates on both sides of the horizon, and they're not getting together and putting some of the practical solutions in place that actually could really help all of California and help America.
Well, I mentioned that Newsom rolled out a sort of expanded plan today. It does include expanding reservoir and groundwater storage capacity by about 4 million acre feet. And, like, you're deep in the water policy. So let me just ask a big picture question. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like we do often have this debate that's like farmers versus fish. But, mm-hmm. like, we all need food and we all need a healthy ecosystem, right? Mm-hmm. Where do you see the kind of broad potential for compromise? And, I mean, you're running for Congress. Like, how can you do that better in D.C. than maybe in Sacramento?
Mm-hmm. Well, I see tons of room for compromise and progress. And I think people put themselves in corners and they're unwilling to even discuss progress. To give you a big picture idea, I'm 44 years old, and in my lifetime, our water supply at the state level has grown by 1%. In that same period of time, we've almost doubled our population. It's obvious we haven't made the investments we need to make. Hmm. Now, I think there are factions of the environmental advocacy folks up here in Sacramento and D.C. who have a bit of a no-growth strategy, right? They think the best thing for the environment is not to build more houses and not to expand development.
How's that going?
And so in a sense, by cutting off our water, that's a way to force a lack of development and investment. I take a more practical view that the population's doubled. We need the food produced in the Valley. The Valley produces, California produces 2/3 of the nation's fruits and vegetables. So just think about that for a minute. If we were to fallow or get rid of 50% of the acreage in this state that we farm, what impact does that have on every state in this country?
Right.
And that's a message I'd like to take to D.C. and go work with my colleagues from other states and say, you know what? The politics of California may have become so left, and there'd be so many members who are, in a sense, in the pocket of the NRDC or the Sierra Club or a group that their constituents are just, you know, have such deeply held beliefs there that they can't compromise in a way that's going to get us the storage we need to sustain the food production. So maybe some of the other states need to help pitch in and have a national, a federal solution for the western states on some of these water supply issues.
So you have been known to buck the party leadership, and you've been punished for that from time to time in the legislature. You know, one of the things that has made Nancy Pelosi so successful in Congress is keeping the caucus together.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to Washington, she may or may not be speaker again, but, you know, would you see yourself as somebody who is following the lead of the speaker, or are you going to continue being this person who challenges the authority?
I'm always going to put my district first. It's just
would you have voted for the climate change bill? Or would you have?
Package,
it's coming up tomorrow.
The package that's up right now. I think I would. I think there's a lot of good in that bill. And frankly, I see that bill as a compromise package. You know, there were folks in the country who were calling for spending that I think was out of control, that would have increased the rates of inflation that we're looking at. And I think some of the good moderates in the United States Senate and even in the Problem Solvers Caucus and the New Dems and some of the other congressional groups kind of held the line. And it took many months and a lot of fighting and a lot of disagreement. But what did we end up with at the end of the day? It was a compromise package that's going to make important investments in tax credits and other mechanisms to help us, you know, fight climate change, right? And also important investments in and price controls, in essence, or price negotiation, I guess you should say, in pharmaceutical, making, you know, prescription drugs more affordable and making electric cars more affordable and renewable energy more attainable. Those are all good things that I think most people on both sides of the aisle would agree with. It's too bad that it was a partisan vote. You know, I tend to want to work in the space of bipartisanship. That's why I was a founder of the California Problem Solvers Caucus, and I've introduced many big pieces of legislation that have been bipartisan. But I think it was an important step forward, and yeah, I think I would have voted for it.
Let me ask you about another kind of high-profile issue right now, which is gun rights ownership. Mm-hmm. You, this session alone, voted no on the bill that would give folks a private right of action to sue illegal manufacturers. You voted yes on ghost gun restrictions. You didn't vote on a couple of other gun control measures. How do you approach that issue? What are your sort of philosophical approach to that? And again, back to your district, what do you hear?
Well, isn't that yet another great example of hypocrisy? So Texas puts a inappropriate law in place to allow litigation, you know, around reproductive rights. And we say, well, that's terrible.
We'll do it.
So we're going to do it. Right. I mean, I just find that absurd. Like, let's get serious here. You know, is gun violence a real issue? Of course it is. And I take my lead from law enforcement, because who do we put in charge of protecting our families and ourselves and our communities? Well, law enforcement. And when law enforcement says to me, this is a gun bill that's going to help us keep this community safer, I take that seriously. And I've voted for many bills over the last 10 years. When law enforcement's opposed to these bills, I guess I kind of ask the sponsors, well, why do we think this is going to make us safer? I mean, what expertise are you bringing to the table? And I found that to be lackluster at best at times, and sometimes very political, right? I get that it's an issue that is red meat for, you know, some progressive Democrats, and they want to throw it out there, but I think it's more important that we be thoughtful.
We're short on time, but you're running for Congress against a nursery owner, a Republican, John Duarte, I think he says it. Is it not Duarte? Yeah. What is it going to take to win that district? It's very purple. It's really a toss-up. And you came in second in June to him. What's it going to take to win?
Well, it was a five-way field in June, and I was kind of the front runner from the get-go and had everybody spending their money to attack me. And I expected that, and we did really well, particularly considering the turnout and Democratic turnout. At the end of the day, this is a 43% Democratic seat, 29% Republican seat. It's 14 points. A lot of independents or declined to state voters here in California, 22%. I've represented two-thirds of this district for 10 years, won five elections. So two-thirds of these voters have voted for me again and again, margins as high as 60%. I am a very moderate Democrat. I work with both parties. I'm the only candidate in this race with bipartisan endorsements. I've got several Republican sheriffs endorsing me, Margaret Mims in Fresno County, Vern Warnke in Merced County, Jeff Dirksey in Stanislaus County, several Republican Board of Supervisor members, as well as all the traditional Democratic endorsements, going all the way up to those same statewide leaders that that Marissa says I fight with.
But, Gavin Newsom, Di Fino, they're all on board. And you're the only one that lives in the district.
And I'm the only one that lives in the district. So I feel like, I understand why the media folks and the folks with the algorithms, and they're going after the competitive districts. And I get all that. And you got to take every election seriously, because nothing's for granted, right? Yeah. You got to go talk to every voter, and you got to earn their vote. I've done it for 10 years, and I'm going to do it again
All right. Assemblywoman Adam Gray, thank you so much for coming in today. That's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We're a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer, Katie McMurrin. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Maurice Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at mlagos. Have a good one.
Think the case for global decline has been oversold? Then you should check out the latest season of What Could Go Right. It's co-hosted by me, Emma Varvalukas, and Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel. What Could Go Right may not have all the answers, but it asks the key questions. Every week, we discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or sensationalism. We talk with guests like NPR anchor Steve Inskeep, democracy expert Yasha Munk, prolific writer and historian Rebecca Solnit, and green energy entrepreneur Jigar Shah. So go ahead, listen to What Could Go Right on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.